You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, you know, it's really appropriate because we say that troll on in all the time, but we're not always trolling. Well, today we are. As a matter of fact, I told you earlier in the program, you're going to meet Dr. Mark Fitchett. He is a scientist with the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, and he specializes in the things that you and I like the most, and those are the wiggly pelagics, the top four, the big ones. And by the way, if you're getting ready for this next week, don't forget we're going to be part of the Kiwala Big Fish Chase, and that's going to be an exciting shootout with the $10,000 prize, and if you catch a big one, you can weigh your money after that. Well, you know, sometimes you catch them, and sometimes you eat them, and sometimes you sell them. And a lot of science revolves around the pelagic fishery. And that's why we're glad to have Dr. Mark Fitchett here. We're going to call him Mark after this. He's a PhD with an interesting background and I suppose either a newfound or a long-lasting love of Hawaii, right?
Exactly.
What got you here to Hawaii the first time?
Well, I've always wanted to come to Hawaii because it's pretty much an island that's very rich in pelagic fisheries. I've always been interested in fisheries oceanography and pelagic fisheries. But I came to Hawaii, worked a year with NOAA, and then an opportunity with the Western Pacific Regional Fisheries Management Council working on pelagics opened up, and it was a great fit. And it's pretty much exactly what I've been wanting to do.
Yeah, so. In other words, tailor-made perfectly for you, right? Here's the thing, gang. It's rare that we get to do what we want to do. I mean, I've likened this before. If you join the Army and you're a dentist, they say, great, motor pool. You know, they put the square peg in a round hole. But I think that here in Hawaii, we have this need for pelagics more than other places because not only do we eat them, but we sell them. And, you know, it's become a very important part. But I'm before we get into the specifics, what about your interest in pelagics in the first place? Where were you when you developed that interest?
Well, when I was an undergraduate at North Carolina State University, I'm from the southeast United States in the South Atlantic. I was working for a grad student. I was working for some grad students at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. And had a roommate who was working, who was going out at sea. He was a grad student. I was an undergrad. Mm-hmm. He was going out at sea tagging white marlin. And he was getting involved with the commercial fisheries in Brazil and throughout the South Atlantic. His name is David Kerstetter, Nova Southeastern. And, you know, he would be at sea for weeks at a time. And we'd have these long, drawn-out conversations. And I was just fascinated by it. So I knew after I finished my undergraduate studies that I would want to be interested in working on billfishes or tunas. And then on top of that, you know, when I was an undergraduate, I had a fairly strong background in quantitative.
Stock assessments.
Number crunching and statistics. And in a lot of... So I kind of used that knowledge base and then started a PhD at the University of Miami. And I was recruited by some professors, my professor Nelson Earhart at the University of Miami, who had been working on billfishes through his entire career. He had been 40 years in the field down at the University of Miami. Dr. Jerry Ault, who comes up here to do work every now and then.
Actually, I met him.
He's tall.
you're no short piece of cake yourself.
Yeah.
Incidentally, though, gang, I want to tell you what the neat thing about this is that there are a lot of people that don't know what a pelagic fish is, and I've always said pelagics are generally thought of as a surface running game fish, and that I mean that's oversimplification, but isn't there some even in our fishery some of an overlap and people don't know what's pelagic and what's inshore and what's reef. And what's a ground fish or a bottom fish?
Yeah, there's a lot of people. There are a lot of distinctions based on movement, and I think that's the big one. Where in the water column that they're located in swimming.
My whole life and a lot of my listeners know are around pelagics and fishing and tournaments. And to me, there's nothing more exciting than the reel going off and you not knowing what's there. Because if you're looking for pelagics, you can catch anything from a 5-pound aku to a 1,000-pound marlin. in the same boat with the same lure on the same day.
And you got guys on kayaks going out there out of Waianae.
Yeah, yeah.
I have friends of mine who have kayaks who go fishing, and they're getting big tunas spearfish.
Yeah. And also, there's a lot of guys now that are fishing with jet skis and this stuff. They got professional little rigs on them. But I think it's the man in the sea. Everybody that loves, you know, the old man in the sea loves that one-on-one relationship that you develop with the pelagic when you're fighting the thing to get it in the boat.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of piqued my interest, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd fished growing up in North Carolina. It's a different fishery. Mm-hmm. So it's funny you say that, because every region, you know, North Carolina, which is marlin, one a day, one a week is a good, that's good fishing. Down in Florida, where it's more sailfish, they're fishing with kites, different spread. And then when I was working on my PhD work down in, I spent a lot of time in Guatemala and in Costa Rica. And in Guatemala, which is the sailfish capital of the world.
Yeah, they tag like 50 fish a day, these ones.
Yeah, I mean, so they pitch bait, and so they'll put the teasers out, and they'll pitch bait. They'll bring the fish in. They don't use dredges. Versus like in the Carolinas, they'll use dredges versus on the east coast of the U.S. versus, and there are so many fish there. And that's an interesting topic, because why are those fish there? It's due to the oceanographic conditions that make it conducive for high catch rates. So every pelagic system is different. So
yeah, you know, the thing that fascinates us is when you start talking about stock assessments. We've been doing that in the last several shows a lot, and mainly because, you know, the fish, you know, in the simplest way is they have no idea what grid they're in. They don't know if they're in the 2 mile or the 20 mile or the 50 mile limit. So it must be sort of interesting when you're trying to quantify certain areas, as this area of the ocean is holding so many of these fish. How do you make a model that can even be anywhere near accurate on that? I'm sure, I know it's a lot more accurate than it used to be.
Things get better, are getting better. I think so, you know, a lot of stocks were assessed based on sometimes, I would say, quasi-arbitrary grids that don't have any biological context. Now, and stock assessments are improving. And like, for example, the issue with big eye tuna, like there's the advancement and the amount of knowledge in the Pacific has grown so much. But for any species, even such as the sailfish in the Eastern Pacific, which is what I'm familiar with, we found that oceanographic conditions that you can detect and you can quantify using satellite technologies, looking at sea surface temperature, sea surface height, the state of the art of physical oceanography has improved tremendously. So you can quantify what is good habitat.
By the way, what's a big sailfish?
A big sailfish?
Yeah, big.
You know, 150 pounder.
Yeah, pretty big. That's big.
That's a big one. Yeah. And they get those down in Costa Rica, Panama, and the Galapagos. And it's funny, we've seen records of, and the catch records from the purse seine fishery far south as the Galapagos, they get them eye fork length, 270 centimeters.
My goodness. Because here, a big sailfish here is 50 pounds.
That's around the pound of one you get in Costa Rica.
But you know what's fascinating to fishermen, and I'm sure there's a scientific explanation, they seem to be a pack fish. I mean, if you get in an area where there's a lot of sails, Costa Rica, when I went there, it's you go through a pile and you get five bites. I mean, they're just all over the place.
Sailfish are more social. And that is something that has been observable, like in Isla Mujeres in Mexico and on the Atlantic side, you get these huge bait balls. And so they're sort of like a pack animal.
Yeah. Surround that bait and just eat all day, right?
Yeah, and there's been so many videos of those feeding frenzies, which are interesting. And that would be a good research topic in its own, is looking at the behavior of them. You know, they corral the bait with their bill. They'll have one that sort of is the hunter who goes in, and they take turns. And it's sort of like a coordinated.
It's like a society, right?
And it's pretty wild to see.
What is interest to all of us, And that is, when you talk about bait balls, we have them here, and there's certain kinds of bait that, you know, that pile up and you see the frenzy going on. But we don't have anywhere here where you can go, like, at, say, down to the landing in San Diego, where you can drive out with your boat, drive up to a bait station and buy scoops of bait. You know, this is two scoops. You give me two scoops. We just have not ever heard of that here. What about it back east? Are there also bait sellers there that go out and catch bait so that all of these troll boats or pelagic guys have live bait.
You know, it's funny you say that. You bring that up. That was a topic that my former supervisor Nelson Earhart brought up, was the lack of forage fish.
Yeah.
And then even in my time down in Miami, I go fishing with friends. I noticed that the price of bait just exponentially increased. They would fish. There's a spot in Miami called the Fowey Rocks, Fowey Light. People would drop and catch their own bait, or they'll pay a guy. You know, goggle eyes were going for about 100 for 10, 100 bucks for 10.
Okay, now, so goggle eye is like an Akuli or an Opelo or something like that?
Similar to them, and they're like candy to for sailfish. And people would be able to catch threadfin and pilchards on their own,
which is a lot of bait, friends. It's all different kinds of bait.
So there definitely is, and so that forage fish concern has been an issue in the East Coast, and then in the South Atlantic and in Florida.
No bait, no fish. Right?
No bait, no bait, no fish, and there's no fishing.
You know what we often have. And we'll get to know each other a little bit more as we progress. But we often have the guys from Wicked Tuna on, you know, different guys from the Wicked Tuna series on this show on a regular basis. Next week, by the way, Tyler McLaughlin, we talk to him. But it's sort of interesting because they catch fish both ways. You know, they're sort of in, when they're at the Outer Banks, I guess they're sort of semi-trolling with their green sticks.
Yeah.
That they bought from POP, by the way. All of those green sticks come from here in Hawaii and go there back east.
And you're starting to see them in Costa Rica, too.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
But it's a different fisherman. I mean, if you get the guy that goes to his marks and anchors up on a pinnacle and then he chums and then he baits, that's a different fisherman than what we got. And I'm sure you've seen that in your time here. We do have people that sit at the buoy, but it's not like the guys that are out just burning fuel.
Yeah. And then it's expensive too.
Yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, let's get back to that to make it pelagics 101. I gave sort of a short overview. What is a pelagic fish?
So, pelagic fish, they're fish that are, in the simple terms, are freely moving. There's not a site fidelity to one area. They move around in the upper part of the water column. Mm-hmm. They may migrate from one natal area to another, an area that they have an affinity to. So some pelagic fish do that. But it's pretty much, we've sort of parsed out groups of coastal pelagics. Then you have your highly migratory pelagics, like your tuna billfish.
Your tuna billfish, right.
You know, and people can even argue, like some of the, sometimes you could consider maybe like in the East Coast, they consider amberjack. Kahale, they consider that a pelagic because it moves. They'll tag a fish and they'll move from 10 or 15 miles, but spend all of its time in the upper water column. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. it's very interesting, gang, because we never used to consider opa a pelagic.
Yeah,
because nobody caught them, and all of a sudden they started getting caught, and everybody thought, well, they're caught. They're the sick ones. No, it was just the fish removed.
That's right.
And so there's more opa around. So that must come as a surprise to somebody, because you don't really think of opa as a surface running game fish.
No, and that's, the opa is a fascinating animal. They've found that there's many different subspecies of opa. We have two here in Hawaii and within the Hawaii Longline that are caught by the Hawaii Longline Fleet.
And what differentiates the two that we have?
I really don't know. It's pretty hard to tell.
There's a lot of people that can't tell the difference between the elephant and a big eye. I mean, they have that group. And I want to break off. I want to get back to the opa in a minute. But a couple of years ago, it was generally embraced that in Hawaii, we have our own yellowfin tuna school. I mean, the yellowfin tuna are not, they live here. They don't migrate to here. And that is why there's so much, I don't want to say animosity, but we want to make sure that the inshore guys don't get their yellowfin being caught by the offshore guys. And so isn't that sort of an interesting thing that yellowfin do run, that they just don't seem to run here?
Yeah, and that's and yellowfin tuna is because of the island mass effect, and you have this large assumed local population of yellowfin tuna from a lot of research.
Because you see these little baby ones, they can't make that cross ocean trek in.
No, and even in the recent work in the western Pacific along the equatorial, they found that there's some genetic work that says, there's a possibility and some plausibility that even within these small island areas that are more close together than Hawaii is to anywhere else, that have their own local you know, biological stocks, which there's some debate there. Mm. But here in Hawaii, you're so isolated.
It's hard to think.
And a lot of tagging.
Exactly. Now, but why doesn't the same hold true with the big eye? Because the big eye generally are on the move as adults, aren't they?
Right. And big eye are larger and are assumed to have more of more mixing between larger geographical areas.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. But I guess maybe, and I don't know, there were some fishermen that were reluctant to agree that they thought that the longliners are catching all the ahi. Well, the longliners are actually fishing pretty much outside of where the ahi are most of the time.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so that being said, I'm still interested in if, like, let's take that for, I brought up the ahi for example, because if we're going to agree, or some of us tend to want to agree that we do have our own local ahi, is it easier or tougher to do a stock assessment?
That's a tough question. Mm-hmm. So when you want to do a good stock assessment, you want to make sure your data that you have is robustly covering the spatial area of that entity. So that's a tough question. And that's not necessarily, doesn't necessarily make it easier. I would defer that. There's a lot of experts here in Hawaii who would be interested in that, and I would defer my opinion.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, as we heard earlier, Mark Filchett is a newcomer, but he's certainly not a newcomer to pelagics. But that must mean that you have a bucket list of stuff that you're looking specifically for to research in our area to compare the areas that you're familiar with us.
And definitely. Yeah. So one of the fish that I've always been really very fascinated by, and is probably the most understudied and elusive of the billfish, is a short bill spearfish, the hebby. That's a fascinating one too, because they're caught probably the highest here in Hawaii. But then periodically for a couple weeks, 3 weeks, I'll talk to my friends in Costa Rica and Guatemala, and they'll start catching a bunch of them, and then they go away.
Suggest they migrate.
Maybe. We don't know. We don't know if maybe due to the oceanographic events, maybe El Nino events or large-scale oceanographic processes, or maybe drawing some of the recruits, some of the small fish towards the EPO, the Eastern Pacific.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know. But that's fascinating to hear. And then, so short-bill spearfish is interesting. You see them in the markets here. It's caught in relatively high abundance relative to other places and other parts of the Pacific.
It seems, by the way, that fish runs more prevalent in the latter part of summer, early part of the fall for local, not too far out trollers. I'm talking about guys that go to the buoys and just beyond.
Yeah, talking to some of my friends who fish here is just interesting. I've yet to catch one myself.
You know what? It's interesting you say that, because a lot of people will say they're smart and they knock down a lot of baits, but they don't get stuck. You know, so you might see one knock down two baits and get stuck on the third one. They're pretty quick, you know, and that must be one of the reasons they're fascinating, because it also looks like there'd be easy predation for other bigger fish.
Right.
But, you know, they must not be, because we have them.
We do have them here, and they're a pretty palatable fish too. And to me, they're fascinating because they're so elusive. They're caught, but there's such little known about them.
Mm-hmm. So in all, I know with subspecies, and it's a hard answer, but when you start taking a look at not just the short bill, but all the marlin, even a lot of people don't get it that they're in the same family kind of as tuna, but they're a little bit different for other reasons. But in Hawaiian waters, don't we have about six different, identifiable marlin?
Yeah, there's a couple. Yeah. And then, you know, you don't get sailfish here in high abundance like you do in other places. Mm-hmm.
It is amazing when you catch one.
What I hear. Yeah. And so we do have a pretty big mixed bag, even relative to other parts of the Pacific of billfishes here. I mean, there's not many places where you will get blues, blacks, stripers, spearfish, sailfish.
Yeah, I mean it's a mixed bag. And you know, incidentally, also, there's always been an ongoing battle, since we're talking about tuna. Let's talk about albacore for a minute, called tombo here in Hawaii, and you don't see them. you don't see the big ones, and you don't see the real small ones either. You see one that's a 50 or 60 pounder, but only at the buoys. Is that also a migratory game fish?
They're pretty migratory. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are recruits that go that make some Pan-Pacific movements. So mm-hmm. there is information. There has been some research done on that. Right now, they just did a stock assessment on the South Pacific albacore mm-hmm. recently. But that's sort of they're my colleagues at the Southwest Fishery Science Center in San Diego have been working on that.
Yeah,
looking at oceanographic variability, because there's been some evidence to show a correlation between movement and recruitment of these fish.
Okay, I want to go right off the reservation with this one question, because it just came to mind, and that is, you know, we hear this big garbage patch, right? We know that there's this place as big as Texas out there, but that it also is a huge nursery of some kind, because albeit that rubbish is very bad, underneath it's very good. There's a lot of fish there. Are you tempted? Are you curious about what is actually out there, what that mass consists of?
You know, I am. Mm-hmm. I'm interested also in what are the latent effects of this on the health of our fishery,
yeah,
health
you
of
bet.
Fish. I mean, yeah, the conventional wisdom would say this large floating mat would provide refuge for small fish, mm-hmm. As well as
food chain, and right?
Contribute to, artificial habitat,
mm-hmm.
if you will, or even serve as a giant fad. But yeah. I'd be more interested in looking at how this is having negative effects on the general health.
I saw one thing. I know it's far afield, but just as an aside, a story the other day. It was a letter to the editor, and it was a Northwest paper in Seattle or Portland, one of those places, and said that the way to do that is to go out there with these ships and burn it. Burn it right on the surface. Just flame the whole top of this ocean. Not as easy. I mean, from what I know about that, sometimes these things are almost microscopic, but there's just zillions of them.
Yeah, if you break things down even more, and the issue with microplastics and breaking it down even more makes it harder for it to be detected or cleaned up. Burning it, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't. It's a little bit out of my wheelhouse. Could talk about.
Yeah, too big. Good to be true. Okay, but you know, honestly, I was asking earlier that when you seize the opportunity to take the gig here and be recruited by the council and come and work, you must, you know, and you explained. By the way, Mark explained to me. You know, I'm new here, so let's not get deep into studies and things that I know of here, because that's where you are. But it would seem to me, because of your interest, you'll be a quick study. I mean, this is right in your wheelhouse to look at all this data and start owning some of it.
Exactly, and that's one of the things I'm really excited about in working with my colleagues here. We have a huge knowledge base of people here in Hawaii, in all the mm-hmm. islands. You have a strong group of retired scientists that worked over at NOAA and at mm-hmm. UH for many, many years. You have UH, you have HPU, you have the Pacific Islands Fishery mm-hmm. Science Center, where you have some world-class scientists. So there definitely mm-hmm. is the ability to answer many of these questions.
Reason I ask is because I want to reach out to this audience and explain to them how you and the scientific community, it's just not nice to have this information. It's kind of important. And so we have to build that bridge. I've seen this change in the years that we've been doing the show. I've seen a lot more secrets being revealed, not necessarily where I caught that fish or exactly the right color, but I'll tell you a little few things if you tell me a few things. So obviously the scientific community wants to go to the recreational community and give them answers, either where to fish or when to fish or what species to look for.
Right, but going back to that knowledge base, you're talking to a lot of the local fishermen here
mm-hmm.
Who fish recreationally and non-commercially. There's a wealth of information that can be tapped.
Yeah.
There's a lot, many, 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 many years of experience on the water mm-hmm. And observations that can either answer questions, but also as a scientist, sometimes it's about asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And talking to these folks and building a relationship with them will help not only further any curiosity we have, but answer some really important questions that could be useful for management transfer of our pelagic fisheries.
Yeah, incidentally, gang, what we're talking about here is what happens at NOAA. I mean, what happens at the council. And you can see a lot of this at wpcouncil.org. Go there often. Listen to some of our last shows. See what's going on. See the projects. See scholarships. There's just a plethora of information out there. And I don't know about you, but I take a look at the website a couple times a week just to see what's going on that I don't know about. But I think that what the partnership that needs to exist between my guys and gals that are listening, the fishers and the scientists, is that the local knowledge probably trumps the knowledge from afar with regards to specific locale, with regards to specific parts of the fishery, particularly the inshore fishery, which I know you don't have a lot to deal with, but the fishermen, we do both, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's, it's like I said, yeah. You know, nobody knows more about the fish that are in the area than oftentimes your fishermen. Because they spend so much time on the water, experience. And most fishermen, from my experience, whether it be in Florida, North Carolina, or Central America, you know, they're pretty affable and amicable to help. They're willing to offer, you know, to a little bit of discussion to help us, to drive us in the right direction.
We want to think that we're unique. Every locale says we're different. Yeah, but we're different. What about your observation, just as, you know, an observer saying, all right, in Hawaii, it seems like the line is very thin between commercial and recreational, because some day you might catch a lot of fish and sell some to offlay your fuel. Technically, that day you're a commercial fisherman, you know, and so right. Local people, it's with licenses and bag limits and size limits, they get kind of nervous because you don't know one day whether they're trying to feed their family or pay a bill.
That's true. Yeah. And then, you know,
is it like that anywhere else you've been?
No, Hawaii. Yeah. You get to, well, in Florida, you do have even in North Carolina, we had recreational commercial fishing, is what they call it, in which people can sell catch, but they don't have a full blown commercial license. They can use commercial gear to feed themselves, subsistence fishing. Florida, in Florida, you have folks that will go day to day. They'll either be a charter for recreational fishing, and then some days they'll fish commercially. But it's nothing like here in Hawaii, where there is, and I've learned very quickly, just the first day I moved here, is there is an intrinsic value to the sea, to the ocean, and to its resources that no other place has. You know, the people of Hawaii have lived off the sea for many, many, many years.
You know,
and
but
there's a connection there.
Yeah, and I love that you made that observation. But I also can tell you that when you talk to some of the kupuna, they can say, you know what, it's different because now there's five times as many people as there were when I was a kid. We're talking to somebody that's in their 80s or 90s now, and saying, but do the fish grow to meet the demand? The answer is no.
No.
And, you know, so you have to have reliable, usable data to know when you flip that switch off for certain kinds of fish annually. But don't the local fishermen know that the seasonality that some of the scientific community might think is different in their bay or on their island?
And that's probably possible. Mm-hmm. That's why it's important to have an open channel of communication with your users and with the fishing community.
When they sit down and say, okay, Mark, welcome aboard, here's your task list, what are you tasked with doing now that you're here and got yourself settled? What are you tasked with doing right now?
Right now, I've been attending, sort of getting a baptism by fire, I was a participant in two meetings in Korea that went over the current state of our fisheries in the entire Pacific, well, in the Western and Central Pacific Ocean. And so I attended several meetings and got to learn from scientists from all over what is the current status state of fisheries throughout the Pacific. Also meeting some of the stakeholders, some of the fishermen here, learning about the pressing issues here. For example, Big Eye Tuna is one of the major fisheries here. They just did a stock assessment, and this that changed the status, much more optimistic that the stock is more healthy. and then tasked with also developing capacity for pelagic fisheries research here in Hawaii.
Yeah, see, that's the key, because I know that people are eager to do that. And I want to, once again, go back to some of the fishermen that have gone out on some of the bottom fishing studies, where they with soak time and travel time and expertise and gear, they really found out that they're not losing quantity or assessment, they're gaining it because of the way it's done. Now, I guess when you started, all of a sudden now we have GoPros and things that we can drop into the ocean and leave unattended and get all kinds of great stuff from.
Yeah.
Isn't that's actually sort of encouraging, I would guess.
It is encouraging, yeah. And with the development of technology, development of computing power, and then also and development of and the expansion of public domain data, satellite data, things like that, even being able now to have an iPad or some device, mobile device, where we can log fishing.
I love that. Yeah.
Catch an effort.
Yeah.
One of my colleagues at the council and I are working on that, building a use of a tablet for the Marianas to work with some of the non-commercial fishers.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because not only at the Maui meeting, but at a couple of other meetings here on Oahu, you talk about hungry birds in a nest that are just dying for the technology that we take for granted on Oahu or in Hawaii or even on the mainland.
Yeah.
These remote areas, not only do they get it, but they really need it. It really is supportive of the type of either assessments or, I guess, feelings of what they've got. They don't have an idea. Therefore, this stuff is good for them. So it's good for all of us when it's good for them.
It is good for them, and it's good to help improve the knowledge, to improve the quality of data we have, and having very strong resolution. I actually worked on when I was a graduate student in Miami, developing logbook systems, satellite logbook systems on some of the recreational boats in Guatemala and in Costa Rica. And the willingness to provide that data was very, very, was very high. The people were more than happy to provide that information, mainly because catch rates are pretty high throughout. So there is the rivalry between vessels. But it was interesting looking at vessel behavior and fisher behavior relative to one another, relative to oceanographic conditions. And it was great to see that, even without having the ability to look at satellite imagery, that these fishermen were finding these frontal movements and were finding where the fish are. And that's a fascinating issue too, but also getting information on what is the what is the behavior and how does that affect the catch rates?
Yeah, and that's what we're going to start to get into next time. If you like what you've heard today in meeting Mark Filchin a little bit and sort of learning on what he's doing, is we're going to start talking the next time we meet on the next step, and that is getting his hands on stuff and actually, I guess, making sure that when you finish a project or a study, you don't want it just to go on a shelf like Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Yeah. You want it used and stuff. That's why the council website's so good at this. Anyway, Mark, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mala.
We look forward to seeing you another time. And that reminds me to remind you, if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And tell your friends. Every Saturday afternoon at 4, every Sunday morning at 7. And I'll see you for my regular show next time. Until next time, you keep tight lines and sharp hooks, following season, big bite. We'll see you.